subsistence is broken in this state, and we have to fix it. The Alaska Native Brotherhood needs to step up. The Alaska Native Sisterhood needs to step up. The Alaska Native community has to step up.
A call for changes to subsistence regulations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 13th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government's top scientist says offshore drilling needs to slow down.
It is coming from a sister federal agency. It's comments submitted from NOAA to the Department of Interior. NOAA is raising objections that we hadn't heard for the last 8 years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
The head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says proposed offshore drilling plans for Alaska's coasts should be reined in because of concerns over oil spills, fisheries, marine mammals, and local residents. Dr. Jane Lubchenco weighed in last month on a proposed five-year Outer Continental Shelf development plan that calls for leases in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and Bristol Bay, as well as Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf Coast regions. In a 26-page report recently made public, NOAA says development should not be done in the North Aleutian Basin because of its environmental sensitivity and the high value of commercial fisheries, particularly in Bristol Bay. It also calls for a ban on Arctic drilling until oil spill cleanup and prevention technology is improved. The report says a precautionary approach should be used in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas because of warming temperatures and opening sea ice, which may lead to unanticipated changes. NOAA's concerns were met with disappointment by the Alaska Governor's Office, which strongly supports the proposed offshore plan. Governor Sean Parnell traveled to Washington last month to ask Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to quickly approve it. The governor's D.C. office director, John Katz, says the state believes offshore drilling can respect the environment and Alaska's coastal people.
Naturally, we would have preferred that NOAA be more supportive of OCS oil and gas development, but then I remind myself that they have certain statutes and a particular perspective which they bring to bear on these issues.
Katz says, by contrast, he believes the Interior Secretary will have a broader perspective because Salazar has said he does support increasing domestic oil and gas production. Katz says it's hard to know if one Obama administration agency's opinion is a signal of a general policy direction, but he says it's not unheard of for departments to arrive at different conclusions.
I think this is part of a normal process that occurs in federal public policy making. The Secretary directs the lead federal agency, but other agencies weigh into federal decisions, and their input is considered along with input from other sources. So I don't see this as particularly significant from that perspective.
Members of the group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, applauded NOAA's comments, saying they represent opinions of some of their members who work at NOAA. PEER's executive director, Jeff Rook, says the report shows the Obama administration is welcoming open dialogue.
We thought this was particularly notable because it is coming from a sister federal agency. It's comments submitted from NOAA to the Department of Interior. And because NOAA is raising objections that we hadn't heard for the last 8 years.
Rook says while NOAA is not the decision maker, the agency's comments may open up future legal challenges.
How much NOAA's concerns are taken into account in setting policy remain to be seen. We thought it was striking that it's the first time it had been articulated. And to the extent the concerns aren't integrated into federal policy, they'll likely be the basis of lawsuits from conservation and Native organizations that sued before.
Interior Secretary Salazar has not said when his department will announce its decision on the five-year offshore development plan, which would run from 2010 to 2015, slowed down the process and extended the public comment period. Before last month's deadline to weigh in, it received more than 500,000 comments, including the NOAA report. alcohol will become unrestricted in Bethel. Bethel has been damp for 32 years, but that's sure to change now. Proposition 1 has passed with even more votes after the Bethel Canvas Board met last night to complete the vote count. The ballot question asked Bethel voters if the city should revoke local option. Bethel voters have approved the measure by 54%. That's one percentage higher than the initial count indicated. The vote means that alcohol will become unrestricted in Bethel on November 1st. Importation limits and rules will be dropped, and individuals can apply to sell alcohol within the city. The results are still unofficial until certified by the City Council. That's scheduled to happen at their meeting tonight. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, concerns over fuel security as communities prepare for winter.
With the disastrous commercial fishing this year on the Yukon, how are we going to make certain that people even have the money to buy the fuel?
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Southeast's oldest Native organization says it's time to confront the state on subsistence. Delegates to the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood's annual meeting called for the state to stop citing Indigenous people who are harvesting traditional foods. They also called for other changes in the government's role in subsistence. One leader facing a state citation says the best approach might be a class action lawsuit. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from the group's Grand Camp Convention in Juneau.
Some Southeast leaders say Natives are being harassed while fishing to feed their villages. They say recent citations have interfered with traditional food gathering in Angoon, Kasan, Yakutat, Hoonah, and other communities. And they say it's time to push the federal government to step in and protect subsistence from state interference. Juneau's Bob Loescher chairs the Alaska Native Brotherhood Subsistence Committee. He says existing limits are unreasonable for people who hunt and fish to fill their freezers.
15 fish per family per year is ridiculous. If we told the people in Juneau that they could only have 15 chickens or 15 pieces of pork or 15 pieces of beef per family per year, how would they like it?
He points out that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act guarantees rural and Native people get preference. And while the state constitution has a different take, the federal approach should be the rule of law.
What we have is a disproportionate allocation between the commercial fisheries and the traditional and customary hunting, fishing, gathering access to our fisheries resources, which we've used for thousands of years. That is not right.
Subsistence citations have riled Native leaders for years, and this isn't the first call for action. But last summer, citation of State Senator Albert Kukesh and three others in Angoon lit a fire. Additional citations in other Southeast villages, as well as Western Alaska, fueled the flames. Peter Narose is general manager of Kutsnuu, Angoon's village Native corporation. He says another fisherman was cited last year in the same place as Kukesh. He challenged the state's authority and beat the rap. But Narose says it didn't solve the problem.
Our shareholders on the beach, not fishing, not taking care of his family, not taking care of his elders. So not only is it vexing to me when these stories come back, but it is straight out harassment of our shareholders.
Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood leaders also object to the operations of the federal government's regional subsistence advisory councils. Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Mike Miller, who's been involved in the subsistence herring egg issue, says non-natives have used the councils to limit traditional use.
For every resource that we have here, whether it's herring eggs or salmon or halibut or anything, if there is a commercial value for it, there are people at every meeting that are not true subsistence users, not from the Native community, that are there splitting it up. And if we aren't at those meetings, then they are claiming it.
Delegates passed about 24 resolutions supporting traditional subsistence practices, opposing state actions, and calling for an increased federal management role. They supported creating a legal defense fund to pay for their efforts. Senator Albert Kukesh said that could include a class action lawsuit on behalf of all subsistence users. Kukesh, in a recorded convention address, says they should act on more than his behalf.
Do it because subsistence is broken in the state, and we have to fix it. The Alaska Native Brotherhood needs to step up. The Alaska Native Sisterhood needs to step up. The Alaska Native community has to step up, and we have to band together to get our subsistence rights back.
Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood delegates even took on the word subsistence. One of their resolutions says the term is often misunderstood and is thought by some to suggest a handout. They say a clearer phrase would be customary traditional hunting, fishing, and harvesting. Further discussion is expected at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention later this month in Anchorage. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood's Grand Camp Convention.
Testimony got heated during a House Natural Resources Committee hearing in Bethel yesterday. Much of the hearing centered on the management of salmon in the Arctic, Yukon, and Kuskokwim region. Comments were gathered from representatives across much of western Alaska and the interior. Many that spoke criticized the state administration and the Department of Fish and Game for their management practices. As Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel reports, regional and tribal leaders wasted no time blasting the Department of Fish and Game.
The Lower Yukon is the most economically depressed area in the state. Jack Schulteis is the manager of Kwikpak Fisheries, the only fish buyer left at the mouth of the Yukon. Schulteis says he was disgusted with the department's treatment of subsistence fishers.
People that were just trying to get food to eat, you know, that's going to be the saddest, sickest thing I've ever heard of in this state. Not only is everybody broke on the verge of total economic collapse, not to eat.
At the beginning of the King Run, Fish and Game estimated that the Yukon was in store for yet another low record, but a sonar at the Canadian border showed that the run was much stronger than Fish and Game had predicted. John Hilsinger testified on behalf of Fish and Game. Hilsinger is the commercial fisheries director. He says the subsistence restrictions were put in place to avoid failing to meet escapement goals set forth in a treaty with Canada. He also said the Yukon is the most difficult river to manage in the state because of its size.
So the decision that the manager makes on, let's say, the 20th of June down in Emonic, he doesn't always know what the result of that decision is going to be until 5 or 6 weeks later.
Karen Gillis of the Bering Sea Fisheries Association says part of the problem is that the state is underfunding management of the river.
When children are going hungry and all we can say is we don't have enough data to change the circumstances, it's a problem that needs addressing today.
In 2007, the state was given approximately $24 million from the federal government for fish research and management. The Department of Fish and Game spent just about 4% of that on projects in the Arctic, Yukon, and Kuskokwim region combined. That's a region that covers over half of the state and a region that has by far and away the highest subsistence use. Many also testified that Fish and Game is ignoring the observations of long-experienced fishermen in the region, fishermen that pointed out early in the season that the King Run was better than recent years. However, Hilsinger says that local input is gathered through several means.
This is an area where the Fish and Game staff has really done a lot to try to work with people to meet with them extensively and does take a lot of public input.
Much of that input comes from advisory councils, and Fish and Game can impose fishing restrictions without the consent of local tribes, a major grievance for several that testified. Dr. John White went even farther by saying the state has undermined a major effort to collaborate with local tribes and fish users. The Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative was started in 2002 as a way to co-manage, but White, who worked on the initiative, says the administrations of former Governors Murkowski and Palin undercut the effort and then cut research funding to organizations outside Fish and Game.
They did these things behind our back, and they cut us off to the place where we now have zero funding in a cooperative research organization, and now they're no longer working with us.
Many urge the lawmakers to stand up for subsistence users, which they say are being overpowered by commercial interests in the Bering Sea. That Bering Sea fleet is responsible for hundreds of thousands of wasted salmon each year. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council is proposing a set of bycatch caps, but Mike Smith with the Tanana's chief conference says those caps favor industry over subsistence. He spoke about a meeting when the caps were proposed.
The subsistence users maybe had 10 people there. The commercial interests brought in well over 100 people to testify, paid their per diem and travel and hotel rooms, and we just can't compete against that type of political pressure.
Representative Mark Newman of Big Lake presided over the hearing. He says testimony gathered at that hearing will help lawmakers when the legislative session begins next year. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The frustration and anger at the legislative meeting only touched one area of concern in rural Alaska. The success and management of fisheries affects the entire economic structure of Western Alaska. Last year's harvests led to winter stories from people who had to choose between paying for food or fuel in the coldest part of the year. Help came slowly from the state government, faster from nonprofit organizations and from churches. Ann Strongheart of Nunam Mikwa says the state hasn't yet corrected the problems people reported then. There has been an attempt to enroll new people for various programs, but in effect, she says, there is nothing now that wasn't available last year.
The warning signs have been there. I mean, after what happened last winter and all the food drives and all the food drops and, you know, the donations that had to come in and all the emergency things that had to happen, I'm sorry, but if I had been in a position, you know, an elected official, I would have been going, whoa, I don't want that to happen on my watch. You know, next year, we need to make certain, you know, that this is not going to happen again. You know, these are the people that elected me or, you know, whatever, and we need to make certain that they're taken care of, you know.
Following this year's fishing season, fuel for heating, cooking, and transportation has risen to the top of rural concerns this year. The Division of Community and Regional Affairs, through its Fuel Watch program, has been tracking deliveries and financing of supplies to rural communities, village councils, and schools off the road system. They report that 85% of those entities are stocked up for winter. For the rest of them, the state is making attempts to resolve supply problems. Air deliveries have begun in McGrath and Tocotna. Barges are making fuel deliveries in Togiak and Tinunak. And financing is not getting in the way. Bulk fuel loans are being granted for several. Strongheart has become an advocate for rural Alaska through anonymousbloggers.com. She says delivery to a bulk fuel supplier does not put fuel in people's homes.
That's fine and dandy, but how are we guaranteeing that people with the disastrous commercial fishing this year on the Yukon, how are we going to make certain that people even have the money to buy the fuel?
In many communities, the only bright spot comes from their electrical supply. All 53 members of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative have received the fuel they ordered back in April and have what they anticipate needing for this year. President and CEO Mira Kohler says, however, that electric service is expensive, with rates now averaging 62 cents a kilowatt. She anticipates a decrease of about 15 cents because of lower fuel prices this year and the effect that will have on the power cost equalization formula.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, fight the flu by washing your hands often or using a hand sanitizer, coughing into your sleeve or a tissue, and keeping sick people at home. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A high-pressure system over Alaska is making for an unseasonably warm October. National Weather Service meteorologist Corey Bogle says there has been record temperatures in the western interior and along the west coast.
Especially McGrath, they got up to 67 a couple days ago and actually established an all-time record high for the month of October. Many places along the west coast like Nome and Kotzebue have had record highs the last couple of days.
Bogle says temperatures have been running 20 to 25 degrees above normal. Fairbanks is experiencing its eighth warmest start to the month. It climbed to 57 degrees Sunday and 51 yesterday. Bogle says the temperatures are the product of an unusually warm high-pressure ridge,
which is actually very reminiscent of what we had back in July, where there was a very persistent warm ridge of high pressure aloft, and temperatures several thousand feet above the surface are actually as warm right now as we would typically see during the summer around Fairbanks. So it's a very unusually warm air mass.
Freeman says the warm, stable air is being heated further by the sun, which is waning, but still up to 10 hours a day in Fairbanks. He says the high-pressure ridge is gradually breaking down, and more normal temperatures in the 30s are expected by the weekend. The Fox Islands group, home to Unalaska and Nikolsky, has been rocked by about 80 earthquakes since last night. A magnitude 6.4 earthquake shook the region around 9:37 yesterday evening and set off a long series of much smaller aftershocks, many with unknown strengths. Then another large one, magnitude 6.3, struck today at 12:21 p.m. Alaska Earthquake Information Center seismologist Natasha Rupert says two large, closely timed earthquakes happen sometimes. She says since both events were similar in magnitude, seismologists call it a doublet. The large quakes were strong enough to be felt in Unalaska and Nikolsky, but did not cause any damage. Rupert says the aftershocks should subside.
Aftershocks is normal occurrence, and normally what happens is with time, frequency and size of the aftershocks decrease. And with magnitude 6.4, we expect that there will be aftershocks for a couple of weeks, but there will be fewer and fewer of those.
Scientists at the Alaska Volcano Observatory say the tectonic earthquakes are not having any effect on the volcanoes in the region and are not triggering any volcanic earthquakes. Last night's large quake took place about 68 miles south-southwest of Unalaska and 76 miles east of Nikolsky. This afternoon's was a bit farther south, about 90 miles from Unalaska. Kodiak is dealing with mudslides because of heavy rainfall. On Friday, the town recorded its second rainiest day ever, 6.40 inches of rain. That's less than the 7.44 inches the town received on Halloween in 1991, when mudslides damaged 5 homes and 50 homes were evacuated. The rain caused mudslides along Rezanoff Drive and Anton Larson Bay Road, which could have been deadly. However, no one was injured. Anton Larson Bay Road remains blocked. Alaska State Troopers are not sure when it will reopen. Andrew McLean has climbed and skied some of the toughest mountains on every continent, but three of his favorites are in Alaska: Denali, Foraker, and Mount Hunter. McLean lives in Utah, but will be in Alaska later this month to give a slide presentation in Anchorage on his adventures in the state. The show is a benefit for the Chugach Avalanche Information Center. APRN's Annie Feit has this preview.
There are a lot of mountaineers in the world and a lot of skiers in the world, but not too many professional ski mountaineers. Andrew McLean has that niche mostly to himself. He makes a living skiing forbidding steep lines of snow on high peaks around the globe. He says it's a sport that can be hard to translate into something most people can relate to.
It's skiing, but it's kind of a different type of skiing. It's not necessarily high speed or dramatic type skiing, so it doesn't film very well. The skiing itself is very cautious because there's a lot at stake. You're looking at 11,000 foot falls. There's nobody there to rescue you. There's no backup or anything like that. So in that regard, it's difficult to explain, but people that are into it really love it.
McLean seems to love it more than most. In 1995, he successfully climbed and skied Denali. In a 2007 print interview, he called that trip a turning point in his life. He said it opened up his idea of what was possible to ski. Since then, his outings in Alaska have included two other peaks near Denali: Foraker and Mount Hunter. He says a big part of succeeding on the high peaks in the Alaska Range is dealing with bad weather.
Conditions up there, you can have hurricane force winds. A lot of people have been blown off them. You can also go from scalding hot to freezing cold within a 24-hour period.
Foraker was McLean's most recent expedition in Alaska last June. On that trip, he and his three partners waited 8 days for bad weather to clear. In the meantime, they spent a lot of time in the tent, playing Scrabble, reading books, and inventing new drinks that will probably never make the Starbucks menu.
There's a butter-infused hot chocolate, where you can melt about half a stick of butter into hot chocolate drinks.
Once the weather improved, climbing up and skiing down 17,000-foot Foraker took 4 days. Just standing on the peak was a major accomplishment. Only one team out of 36 succeeds. At the top, the group encountered dangerous crevasses and icy snow conditions. Not exactly the endless fluffy powder many skiers dream about.
No. If you get good skiing, that is kind of a bonus, icing on the cake, so to speak. A lot of it is just the experience of being there. These peaks are unlike anything else, where they're very high and they're very difficult to get to the top of. And just being on the top of them and putting on skis and being able to, you know, stand up there and look around and ski down them is really what it's all about.
The Foraker trip went smoothly, but climbing and skiing such inhospitable terrain can be a life-threatening endeavor. McLean says managing the risks is a big part of ski mountaineering. He carefully plans each expedition and builds in extra time for going slow and waiting out weather. But he's seen a lot of tragedy in the mountains.
I've had a few friends die either in avalanches or falling to their death. You learn from each time that happens, and you hope it never happens to yourself, and you kind of take precautions.
On McLean's remote expeditions, there are no avalanche forecasts to consult, but he's a big believer in the importance of avalanche information centers for backcountry skiers. His talk will benefit the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center in Girdwood. He says the centers can save a lot of lives, but they have a hard time finding funding.
Avalanches are a tricky thing to forecast and a very important thing to look out for when you're backcountry skiing. They're probably the number one hazard when you're out backcountry skiing. If you're in a ski resort, a lot of that is taken care of for you by the ski patrol, but once you venture outside of the main gates, you're kind of on your own. And the avalanche centers go a long ways towards forecasting what the dangers are and what to look out for.
McLean's slide presentation will be at the Beartooth on October 22nd. It starts at 8 p.m. and costs $10. He's calling it Alaska Family Values, Father Denali, Mother Foraker, and the wild child, Mount Hunter. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Army officials say the process of combining Elmendorf Air Force Base and Fort Richardson into one joint operation will begin early next year. The joint installation in Anchorage is a result of the 2005 base realignment and closure process. Across the country, 26 facilities are being combined into 12 bases. The Anchorage transition to one base will begin January 31st and is slated for completion by October 2010. A commander for the joint facility has not yet been named, but Colonel Timothy Pryor, the commander at Fort Richardson, will be the deputy commander of the joint base. The plan has been in the works for 4 years, and vice chiefs of the Air Force and Army signed off on the plan on Friday. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Annie Feit from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
And by
BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.